Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
This is John Meadows.
This is Mike Bataxi.
This is Donna Bataxi.
And I'm Alex Lokes, and I'd like to welcome you to the February 2015 episode of Classic Camera Revival, live from Meadows Studio in Toronto, Canada. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. Today's topic is box cameras. Why box cameras in February? Well, because February has a wonderful day that is Take Your Box Camera to Work Day. So we have three great cameras ready to review, plus we're going to discuss printing at home in your own darkroom.
Plus, let's face it, February, most times, especially here in Canada, it's really bloody cold. I mean, freeze the brass off a bald monkey cold. Get rid of batteries. What are you left with? Either a mechanical camera, which, let's face it, they can have their own set of faults.
Absolutely.
Or a box camera. How can you go wrong with a box?
Exactly.
At the end of this episode, we want you thinking in the box.
Yep, absolutely. Now, there's one thing that I would always do when I would introduce people to photography. I would bring out my modern digital camera, and I would bring out a 1916 Kodak Brownie. I would set them down on the table, and I'd ask them one question. At the very basic, do these cameras work on the same principles? Everyone would think no, and then I'd walk them through the basics of photography. And then they realize that at the end...
They do.
I mean, you don't need anything more than a light-tight box with a lens and a recording medium on it. So why not? Let's get started with Donna.
Okay, today I have the Brownie Bullseye. It's made by Kodak between 1954 and 1960. It was designed by Arthur H. Craspy, who also designed the Kodak Brownie Star series. It's a 620 film camera with 8 6x9 exposures. The Bullseye has an eye-level viewfinder and a large shutter release button on the front vertical edge in front of the winding knob. It's available in black with a light gray winding knob and focus shutter. And that was released out 1954 and 1958. You could also get it in beige, called gold back then, with black controls from the 1950s to the 1960s. It also has another neat feature. It has a tripod socket for long exposures on the bottom. It's very light. Not my kind of a camera. I don't really like box cameras.
What's wrong with a box?
I don't really like them. I find them very boxy, very big, very...
tripod socket. That is cool, category. Yes,
I agree, yep, but absolutely. It's just not...
And it focuses. It's a box camera with a tripod socket, it focuses.
It's not a camera that I would choose to take out. But overall, it's a good camera, and I think everyone needs to try one.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I've used this. I can't deny it. I've used this camera, and I actually really like it. I don't know. There's... Something about it. I mean, maybe it's the 6x9 negative. That's usually a bonus.
Yeah. That's huge.
But it's maybe just because it's just so simple. I mean, you don't have to worry about metering for exposure. You just point
and shoot
and click.
Focus.
Well, yeah, focus.
Well, it followed the Kodak mantra of the era, where it's you press the button, we do the rest.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right, and for me, that's what's the biggest draw of the box camera is that, I mean, I shoot with a 4x5, I shoot with medium format 35mm. Sometimes it's just nice to get out and not think about everything and just focus on what you're going to shoot.
It's basically a lazy camera.
Sometimes lazy can be good.
What I find interesting about box cameras is that you can go out and buy very expensive gear, mm-hmm. very expensive software, or expensive, you know, Lomo type cameras.
Yep.
That whose only goal is to try and duplicate the look you get
what you have.
From a $10 box camera. So
that's
why
true.
Cut out that's the middleman, get one of these.
Absolutely. And to continue on the Kodak theme, the camera I have with me today is the Kodak Hawkeye Flash. Now, this is also a 1950s camera. very similar to the Bullseye, but it only does a 6x6 negative on 620 film.
B now, B square.
620 film is essentially 120 film, but on a different spool. And most 620 cameras won't accept a 120 spool, but the Hawkeye Flash will. You just have to make sure you have a 620 take-up spool. So it makes it very... it makes 620 film accessible. Just make sure that you get the take-up spool back from your lab or do it yourself at home.
Or do what I do and roll it back onto a 120 spool. Then there's less chance of your lab losing it if you don't do it at home.
Exactly. And the one thing I really like about it is simply because it gives that really nice, soft look to the images, right? It's very dreamy, very 1950s.
Now, with your Hawkeye, I've been seeing a lot of images online, and people flip the lens.
Yes.
Have you done that with yours?
No, I haven't. I don't... That's not particularly my take
on
it.
What do you mean by flip the lens?
Well,
on your head?
Inside the Hawkeye, it's using a very basic lens, which is known as a meniscus lens.
Single element.
Yeah. Okay. What you can imagine a meniscus, look at a cup of water, fill it all the way up to the brim, that very top bubble, which it actually will sit above the lip of the glass. That's called the meniscus. A meniscus lens, exactly the same principle.
That's right.
It's just a curved piece of glass.
So you flip it, and it really enhances that dreamy look to
That's
it.
Cool.
It came about when someone was going and cleaning their lens and put it in backwards and realized, hey, wait a minute, this actually produces a really nice result.
I am so trying that.
I've seen some amazing shots. I mean...
That's kind of cool.
We're looking at... You look at one shot from the Hawkeye, and you know what? Soft edges, exactly what you'd expect from a box camera. But when you flip it, it is a super, super sharp image in the middle, which is very typical of meniscus lenses. Mm-hmm. But the fall off for the soft corners is so immediate, and it's just blown way out of proportion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is phenomenal, the look.
Do you have to do surgery to the camera, or you're basically unscrewing it and screwing it back in backwards?
No, you actually have to unscrew the body.
Yeah. But you don't have to cut anything or hack?
No, there's no hacking involved. And again, the Hawkeye Flash, they were the snapshot camera, so they are cheap and they are plentiful these days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got mine in a carrying case, the original flash holder, manual, and a roll of film for $20 at an antique store.
And that would be considered expensive.
Yeah.
But then again, with the original box and everything, I mean, that starts making it almost like a display piece, too.
That's really cool.
I mean, that is pretty awesome.
And I honestly think that they shot maybe it once or twice. I mean, this thing is mint.
Now,
mint condition.
Do you have... I know this probably shouldn't be said today, but this is what Kodak called it, the original midget flash.
Yes, I have the flash unit that came with the camera as well.
That's pretty awesome. Because it wasn't until I started to go further into my Kodak collection that I got the little 127s, like the star mites and stuff like that, where I actually got a midget flash.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like it. And I mean, there's something to be said about these flash bulbs.
Yeah.
I mean, Donna can attest to how much she hates flash bulbs, but there's something about them. I don't know what it is. It's just you don't get the same feel of an electronic flash.
It's not that I don't
like
them. They're really cool. It's just they really hurt the eyes.
Now, and also a word of warning, for flash bulbs, they're probably, if you try them, they're vintage. Most of the flash guns that I've seen, you can put like a plastic cover over it, because occasionally you'll get one that explodes.
Yep.
I don't want to scare anyone, but I think we need to be responsible here.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I agree.
Especially as time goes on, as they get older and older, more and more vintage.
That's right.
The reliability goes down, so you want to protect yourself.
Absolutely.
Flying glass can ruin a shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just want to put this out there. There are two types of bulbs. There's the clear bulbs and there's the blue bulbs. Blue bulbs are balanced for daylight. Clear bulbs are the same flash as such as a tungsten, which you can use it with a tungsten based film, or what everybody usually used it for was black and white. Now the blue bulbs, as John was mentioning about a cover, If you want it to be tungsten based, yes, you can peel the plastic off, which I did. Word of advice, make sure you have a cover, because when I fired it, as he mentioned, exploding bulbs, yes, it exploded. Yes. It was millions of little pieces everywhere. Yeah. It was not a fun moment for me and for Donna when she came walking by and started cursing and swearing at me with a couple of pieces of glass on her feet. Not smart.
So please, you know, we cannot be held responsible for photographic activities that involve fire and explosions.
But don't let that scare you. Do give it a try. Yes. It is a lot of fun.
But with the appropriate precautions.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I can't stress flash bulbs enough. They're absolutely fun.
Practice safe flash.
Yeah, exactly. practice safe flash.
Yeah. Now, if you want to actually work with 120 film more, you can still buy it. Fresh stock, you can go to filmphotographyproject.com and look in the store. They also manufacture new plastic film spools if you get a camera that doesn't have a spool in it. And the price is actually reasonable and the shipping is fast. We'll make sure that the link to their store is in our show notes.
Absolutely. I agree. I definitely will have to say that 620 film from the FPP, two thumbs up. Right on, guys.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're not talking like old stock here. We're talking fresh.
New stock.
Kodak, Fuji, Ilford stocks that are just hand spooled to 620.
Yeah. So kudos for you, Michael Rosso. Great job. Keep it up.
And also because, you know, the film, it's the negative film is the exact same as 120. The only thing that's different is the spool.
That's right.
If you have 120 spools, and if you remember the changing bag and or changing box we talked about in our first episode, it is not difficult to re-spool 620 film, or sorry, 120 film onto a 620 core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Will work, guaranteed. Because you can pay an awful lot for sort of boutique 620 film.
Mm-hmm.
B&H. Whereas 120 film is, you know, well, it's film's not cheap, but it's a lot cheaper buying it in 120.
That's right.
Now, the other thing I do, I'm not going to suggest everybody do this. It takes a little bit of practice. I actually will remove the 120 spool from the 120 spool. I take it right out. Gone. What I do is I unroll the film, obviously in the dark, take out the spool, and re-roll it up without a spool in it, but I roll it up a bit tighter, and it fits perfectly right into the back of the camera, feed it across to the 620 take-up, and sure enough, no problems. I have never once had an issue. Yep. I've had other people have done the same thing. I've mentioned about it. They try it. They think it's fantastic. When they've tried to trim down a 120 spool or they don't have another 620 spool to use, they end up with some other issues with their camera, binding, grabbing, or there's been times where the camera just stopped advancing. It just binded right up and that was it. They took the spool out. They managed to roll it up nice and tight, fit it into the back of their 620 camera. Beautiful. Worked perfect.
Excellent.
Good.
Now we're going to hop across the pond a little bit, and Mike here has an Agfa box camera he's going to talk about.
Yep, the Agfa SureShot box camera, made 1923. Now, this camera, kind of interesting, because it was classified as a full-frame 6x9, and take the holder out, flip down two little black flaps, and suddenly you have a 645 half-frame box camera. This was pretty innovative with this little camera.
You guys have all the nice toys.
And we do. So I have used it both ways.
This is so staying in, Mike.
Oh, you suck. Okay, so I've used it in both formats. Now, in the viewfinder, make sure that when you clean the viewfinder, clean the metal, very careful with the glass, because there are these little black lines that they're for masking out if you're using it in 645. Now, there's two viewfinders on this. Looking down from the top, you have the portrait orientation, unless you're in 645, and then it's the landscape. Flip it on its side, and in 6x9 is now landscape orientation, or in 645 is portrait orientation. Right. Now, The other thing that's really nice about this camera is you have a slider on the side that adjusts the diaphragm. Pull it out to one mark, and that's filtered. This camera comes with a built-in K2 yellow filter.
Oh, really? Cool.
Talk about advanced, right? So after you get to the K2 yellow filter, pull it out a little bit further, and it actually stops down the lens to roughly around f22. So you're shooting a faster film, say 100 ASA, or I guess would be ISO since everything's been standardized. Stop it down, but then there also has long exposure. Yes, I have used it. There's a second tab that says time on it. And since this is the Agfa SureShot, this one is actually a U.S. import. So hence why I got it from the U.S., from the second owner. When you put it in time mode, release the shutter, and it stays open. Which you can do long exposures, infrared. Obviously. Infrared, yes, I've done it. And the only thing is, you have to be really careful on a tripod because there's no mount. Why there's no mount and it has a time mode, hey, it's made out of cardboard. What more do you want? So, why a box camera? I've been asked that a few times. And one of my simplest answers is because it always works. Mm-hmm. I have never once bought a box camera that didn't work. I mean, Alex is talking about a 1916 Brownie, and guaranteed, you flip the shutter.
Still works.
Yep. I've used cameras 10 years old. Put the battery in, nothing. And it's brand new batteries, just dead. Yep. Well, 100-year-old camera, still working to this day. Photos are absolutely stunning. I'll make sure I link a couple of images that I've took. And yes, they will be infrared from on the show notes. Now, how did I use infrared on this thing? A little bit of hope and prayer, because I just kind of hung the filter with a lens hood on the lens mount itself. Or, well, it's not really much of a lens mount. I just hung it and just hoped and prayed that a wind didn't come along and knock it off. But no, you know what? Will I do it again? Absolutely. I absolutely loved the effect.
It's something that I want to try, and especially combine infrared, black and white infrared film. I guess we'll talk about that eventually at some point. Yep. Combine that with the switching the lens, putting the lens in backwards.
Now that I look forward to seeing. Absolutely. Incredible.
That will be interesting.
And I won't have to pay for any Photoshop plugins to do it.
What I really like about the camera is because it's 1920, it has a decent Art Deco style on the
it does.
Front. I'm a sucker for Art Deco, both in camera style and building style, personally. Yeah.
This one, I think, it may have gotten a little bit of moisture involved because the Art Deco is a little bit faded. I mean, I've got a Jiffy 616 that I've run film through. The thing still works. It takes awesome photos, provided that you don't get light leaks from the bellows that you could probably strain coffee through. I don't know. There's just something about it. And when I first got this camera, the lens was a little fogged up. And I can't believe how simple it is to clean. I mean, it's got a front. On the front, there's actually a protection glass to protect the shutter. And the shutter is in front of the meniscus lens, which is in the film housing, like the actual carrier for the film, which is removed from the body. That's where the lens is. And I took it all apart. I cleaned that lens, and I noticed that the glass, the protective glass from the outside of the box to the shutter, was kind of hazy. I managed to get the front of this camera right off, and I mean, it's the most simplest of design. It's just a guillotine shutter. It's got a blade on a spring, push a button, it flips up out of the way for roughly about 1/30th of a second, which I believe that was, or probably 1/25th, considering the time that was the slow shutter speeds, it was about 1/125th of a second, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, fantastic camera.
A couple of suggestions I'd make overall for box cameras. If you're going out to get one, unless you don't mind getting a bit esoteric with film stocks, the two formats you want to look for are the 620 that we've mentioned or the 120.
Yes.
When you start seeing film formats like 116 or 616 or 127, like for things like a baby brownie, it's not like you're not doomed to failure, but then you're talking about getting 70 millimeter stock and running onto cores. It gets very difficult. So I'd say your first foray into box cameras, look for 620 or 120. Absolutely. And also, I think the choice of film is important. I would recommend something like ISO 100 speed, because yes, that's basically what they were designed for, yep, 64 to 100 speed film.
Now, speaking on that, on the AGFA, one of the things it says is it uses B2 film. Now, AGFA used a different letter designation. There was D film and there's the B2 film. D film is 116, B2 is 120.
Yes.
So make sure you get an AGFA, make sure it's B2. Mm-hmm. Don't go anywhere else, because you're basically going to be F for film stocks.
Yeah.
And these box cameras, unless you have something that is very rare, don't let the antique dealer tell you that this is a $200 camera.
No, don't pay anything more than $20.
Yeah. Yeah, my SureShot eBay, I was the only bidder, 99 cents, cost me $20 in shipping. So, I mean,
there we go.
It was, and as soon as it arrived, I was shocked at the camera. I thought to myself, why did I buy it? You know what? This camera, out of any of the other simple box cameras I have, my SureShot, I have no problems turning to it. I love it.
My first real camera was a Brownie Hawkeye that I got as a teenager in the 1970s. Paid $1.50 for it at a church rummage sale. Of course, $1.50 was real money back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, that was the day you could go to a camera store and buy a Verichrome Pan 620.
Yep.
Back in... Yes,
very nice.
Oh, boy. Verichrome Pan.
Lovely film.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, we're back. And so last episode, last month, we were talking about developing your own black and white film. So now we get into the next step, which is a little more advanced. It's about doing traditional darkroom printing at home. Again, most labs these days, when you send your black and white photos in, even film stock, when you send it in to get them printed, it's scanned and inkjet printed. There's a few labs out there, Blue Moon Camera and Machine out in Portland, Oregon, that still do traditional wet darkroom work. But, again, with labs and stuff closing, the equipment is becoming more and more readily available, and at a really good price point, too. A lot of the equipment you can actually still get for free. So what do you need to get to start printing at home in a traditional method?
Well, as I don't know if anybody remembers from last episode, Donna had mentioned trays. That is a definite you will need.
Yes.
And they come in, you can get any trays from 4 inches all the way up to like 16
yep,
by 20.
Yeah, different sizes.
Even bigger.
Frames.
Yeah.
I'd suggest, you know, getting, they say it's good practice to use a tray that's one size bigger
yep.
than the print. So
that makes sense.
If you're printing 8 by 10, ideally you want 11 by 14. Now, I'll be honest, my dark room is very small. I don't have room for 16 by 20 trays, so I do 11 by 14 in 11 by 14 trays. Yeah.
I find 11 by 14 trays with 11 by 14 paper, yeah. It's ample.
Even 8 by 10 and 8 by 10
yep,
trays is
yep,
fine
that's
enough.
What I use.
Now, the one thing that is 100% important when doing darkroom printing is you need a light-tight space.
Oh,
or
yes.
Or a space that you can make
right.
reasonably yeah. light-tight.
Well, my darkroom's not exactly light-tight. I mean, yes, I've blacked out the windows, but
yep.
once the sun comes up in the morning, there's still light down
yep.
there, and I'm still making beautiful prints.
It's not as bad, but the requirement isn't as nasty as it is for film negative.
No, 100%
because
that.
Photographic paper is
yeah.
not nearly as sensitive as film is, but you want it to be as light tight as possible.
Yep. Absolutely.
My dark room, like I will do film print, or I'll do photographic printing in the evening. Now, yes. Of course, the good news is that you're not doing this all in the dark. That,
absolutely.
You're using what's called a safe light, which is a light that will have an orange or red filter, so that you can see what you're doing, but the photo paper that you print on is not sensitive to the red or orange light.
Unless you have panel lure paper. If you've got some vintage Kodak panel lure paper,
Which is pitch black. Which is probably not what you're starting with.
Yeah.
No. Well, it was used for printing black and white negatives from, or printing black and white prints from color negative films.
Yeah.
And I truly wish that I had a little bit more of that stuff, but sadly.
And it's not something you want to cheap out on either as your safe light. You want to make sure it's a proper safe light.
Yeah.
You can get them from most photographic supply store, Burlington Camera would carry them, or you can go online and go to Freestyle Photographic.
Or if you ever see online, you can see Kodak Brownie developing kits. Many times they come with a safe light. Now, chances are that little safe light, it's a 7-watt...
junior bulb.
Yeah, a 7-watt junior bulb with the screw-on cover. Now, a lot of them, believe it or not, they came with different colored covers. You had yellow, which worked as an amber filter, which is fantastic. I prefer the amber. You had red, which obviously red. And then there was green. Now, the nice thing about green is certain films had very, very low sensitivity to green. Right. Fomapan 400, very low sensitivity to green. You can actually tray develop Fomapan 400. Now, be very careful because you don't want it to see the light too long.
That's
you can check density of the film if you're not sure. But again, be very careful because that can fog your film if you expose it too long.
But for the most part, you'll be working in an amber or a red light for printing.
Yeah, definitely.
And of course, the big thing that you need is an enlarger.
Yeah, and the good thing about enlargers is quite often, if you wait around, if you're patient, you'll find someone who has one gathering dust in the basement and say, when can you come over to pick it up?
Yes.
Buying them online, you're paying shipping fees. These are not small things. And basically, because what enlarger does, in a sense, it's like a slide projector. You put the negative in the negative holder, and you're projecting the projected image through the negative onto an easel, which will hold your 5x7, 8x10, 11x14 paper. There are like a number of like decent brand names like Besseler, Omega,
Durst,
Bogens. There's another
Bogens.
Yeah, or even Leica. Leica does have one.
Yeah.
And no, believe me, you do not pay Leica prices for a Leica enlarger.
Yeah.
And so so we have the enlarger. The next thing I need to make sure is the enlarger comes with a lens.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that enlarger lenses are dirt cheap.
Yeah.
Even like you can like a Nikkor made, you know, very highly regarded enlarger lenses, like a 50mm. Yeah. Under $50 sometimes.
Exactly. And you pick the lens based on your negative. So if you're shooting with a, if you're enlarging 35mm film, you'll want a 50mm lens. Mm-hmm. If you're enlarging 120 film, medium format, you're looking at a 80mm lens. And if you are lucky and have a 4x5 enlarger, you're looking at least
135,
a lot of people say.
Yeah, well,
you're basically looking at what's known as normal focal lengths based on the film stock you're putting in there.
The other thing you have to watch out for is as you go to larger films, watch your corners with the lenses because you'll get a vignette, which if you're printing, some things that you can do is make sure that your negative falls into the center of the light fallout. If you're finding that your image is starting to get out into the corners where you're getting a lot of fall off into the vignette, you may want to try cropping your image. I know a lot of people don't like doing that. Or next step is try to find a lens that is a slightly longer focal length.
That's right.
So we talked about the enlarger. I mentioned the easel, and I'll talk a bit more about the easel. And what it is, it's the piece of gear that that holds the paper in place. So sometimes they're spring loaded. They're various kinds. They're kinds that can do borderless as opposed to ones that have a border. For me, I have a couple of easels. Sometimes if I'm doing 8x10, I have a small easel. That's all it does. 8x10,
yep.
It's
nice, yep.
It's
nice and easy. Yep.
But then I've got one that'll go up to like 11x14.
Mm-hmm. I have that one like that too. Yeah.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with having a couple of different easels. And the other thing I would mention is that a lot of the we're not talking too much about paper today, but you'll see a lot of paper called polycontrast or variable contrast. And this is paper that will give you different degrees of contrast based on the use of what's called a polycontrast filter. So you would need a set of filters, and mm-hmm. they go in between the lens and the board,
yep.
or somewhere in the light.
That's right.
In the light path, and based on the color of the image that's projected onto this polycontrast paper, you will get mm-hmm. anything from very, very soft contrast. So if you have a very hard contrasty negative, you can use that nice soft end of the contrast range. Or if you have a negative that's very, very flat, or perhaps underexposed, and you need to salvage it, you can have a very, very hard or high level of contrast. Now,
that's right. The
old days, you had to buy, you know, one box of my contrast level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You had to buy 5 different boxes of paper. With the polycontrast paper, you buy one stock of paper, and you have the filters, and it's versatile, flexible. And you save money. And I'd say, unless you start going for specialty stuff now, 90% of the paper on the market is polycontrast.
Yep.
Yes.
I do see the odd graded stuff. Yeah. I've been wanting to try graded stuff just to see if how much of a difference it makes when putting the image onto a graded paper versus using a polycontrast using filters. The other thing that I've been finding is... with polycontrast, especially resin coated, I find it's already more or less a contrast level of 2.
Yeah.
So I've been basically printing without any filters and almost getting a fantastic look corner to corner on every image. Absolutely stunning.
And just to sort of put it in context, papers typically range from contrast level 0 up to 5 or sometimes a 6.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule of thumb is that if you have a correctly exposed normal negative, you're somewhere around a 2, perhaps 2.5.
Which is why most papers are rated at around a 2 these days.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Speaking of papers, one thing that has been really handy is paper safes. Because, I mean... you will eventually need to turn on the lights in your dark room. And while paper is packaged really well, they're in dark bags. The bags are actually really handy to keep around once you've exhausted the paper.
They are, yes.
So a paper safe is a must. Absolutely. Plus, it makes it easier to get the paper in and out. You're not opening a box or flipping open a flap.
One of these days, I have to invest in a paper safe.
or forgetting to close the box.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
And that paper's expensive. It's not cheap. Yeah.
It can be, yep. Especially the higher end, fancier papers, definitely.
Yep.
Adox, there's one that their papers are they're not cheap.
So, and one more thing you'll need is multiple sets of tongs.
Yep.
Like some people do it with their hands. I think it's better to do it with your.
Please use your tongs.
Yeah, and gloves.
And especially if you get into using toners.
Most of the chemicals we've talked about, like in our last episode, are not particularly toxic.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to things like toner, that's a different discussion altogether.
That's right. Yeah.
And for tongs, I'd say you want multiple sets. So you're not dipping the tongs that were in your fixer or stop bath
back into
the developer.
Have a tong for each tray.
Unless you're using stainless steel tongs. But that's another...
I would say at least have one set of tongs that are only for developer.
Mm-hmm.
But I find stop and fix
is no big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all about avoiding contaminating your developer.
That's right.
The other thing is with printing is, although with film you can use water for a stop bath, printing you have to use a chemical stop. I have done it with water, put it in fix, and my paper looked like it was covered in rainbow bright. It was terrible. And believe me, you don't want that to happen.
And even if it's just water with water vinegar mix.
Yes, that works fine.
You don't actually have to go out and buy a full chemical stop. I mean, when I do printing, that's what I do.
Yeah.
It's just a dash of acid. Well, that's all stop
bath. Now, the advantage to using a commercially available stop bath, such as Ilford's indicator stop or Kodak's indicator stop, is when the stop bath is exhausted because of too much developer being transferred from the paper into it, when you go from developer bath to the stop bath, under your safe light, it will turn almost like blood. It will look like blood. It is. Mm-hmm. It's actually really cool when you see it, but when you turn on the light, it's purple, and that means that the stop bath is now exhausted, and you dump it and mix yourself up some new one. And believe me, it is fairly cheap. Or as Alex uses, just use a
water and vinegar.
Water and vinegar. You use what one to ten.
1 to 4.
One to four. Fairly strong. 1 to 4. Okay, so 1 to 1 to 4. So
get that potato chip smell happen.
Exactly, and you know what?
Hey, you know what? If it blocks out the smell of the selenium toner, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with a little bit of vinegar in your diet.
Exactly.
Once you've developed the print, and it goes through the wash, and we'll probably talk more about the chemical steps at a later time.
That's right.
You have to hang the print to dry. Now, the two kinds of paper. There's what's called RC, rosin coat, which is more plastic than paper. You hang it up, you know, with a clothes peg, and it'll dry pretty flat. That's one of its advantages.
Mm-hmm.
The other kind of paper is fiber-based, often called FB for short, and it's real paper. In some respects, will give superior results. That's another religious discussion.
We'll be talking about paper later.
When it will not dry flat by itself, although if the thicker the paper, the flatter it will dry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you want to look at weighing it down. And then resign yourself to, you know, if you don't have any big heavy photo books, now's a good time to buy them, because they also, you put the print in the book. And here I want to give one word of warning, especially if you're buying used gear. You can see things what are called print dryers.
Yes.
The problem with the print dryer, and remember my high school teacher told me this, is that if there's a contaminated print, like a print just like a negative, you have to wash the fixer off.
Yep.
If you put a print in a print dryer that was not properly washed and has a fixer contamination, it can migrate to the print dryer, and then the print dryer becomes a vector, in a sense, for ruining other prints.
Mm-hmm. That's terrible.
Now, you can also get print drying books, which are basically these bound
things. I have some of those.
Blotter paper. Yeah. Nothing wrong with them, or even a print dryer, but you have to be very, very fastidious in washing your print before you use them.
RC and you can use HypoClear on prints as well, and that really helps.
Yeah.
The darkroom I use, we basically use a basement bathroom, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So we have a source of running water, and we have the prints washing for a good 10-15 minutes.
Yeah. Now, is that resin coated?
RC.
Okay, so 10 minutes with resin coated, that's fine.
It's more important fiber.
Is, at least 40 minutes running water.
That you use the HypoClear step, that you do it. And then the final step that I do with my prints is toning, right? And that's in selenium.
That's before they get dried, just to be clear.
It's, for me, the process is develop, stop, fix, HypoClear, wash, tone, another wash, and then it gets hung out to dry.
Or as I like to tone, I use coffee. And you know what? Coffee and RC paper doesn't really work. You get a little bit of stain. Fiber base.
Beautiful.
It is just gorgeous.
Of course, the selenium toning, in addition to giving a very nice look and bringing up the tonality, it also helps make a print archival.
Yes.
Yes, it does. So
if you selenium tone a print and wash a print, like we've all seen inkjet prints that after a couple of years have faded.
Yeah.
A properly processed selenium tone black and white print will last an awfully long time.
And it won't run. If you get it wet, it will just get wet.
And a nice thing about a coffee stained one, it doesn't smell like selenium.
Okay. We've talked about the mechanics about doing a darkroom print, but what I want to mention is that there's a special moment in every sort of film photographer's life.
Life.
The first time you see when you're the print, because you can watch the print develop
That's
under
right.
the safe light, magic. And you see the print arise out of nothing.
Yeah.
That, I'm getting chills, and I've done thousands of prints.
Oh, yeah.
That is one of those particular joys that you, sorry, you don't get with digital.
Yeah.
No, that's true.
But you get with film photography.
That's right.
And I'd also say that, let's say, most photography is consumed online,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of the great leveler in terms of quality.
Yeah.
But if you go and see a properly done black and white print on good paper of a good negative, you'll get an aha moment. And you'll see, yes. that's why film photography still matters.
Yes.
But you've got to see it in person.
Yeah. If you're looking for a room to set one up in, you want it to be reasonably light tight, you're going to need access to electricity, and you're going to need access to water. You can bring it into another room to wash it and tone it.
The one thing that was missed is a timer. You need yes. a good timer, either a Graylab or mm-hmm. any other kind of timer that you can work with, especially one that you're in larger plugs into.
Yeah.
That is really important.
We use, I use a Durst in larger, and it's plugged into an Omega timer, which is actually really nice because we can go down to tenths of a second.
Nice.
Right?
Wow.
Or we can go like, I can do a print at like 5.5 seconds, or I can do it upwards to 99 wow. seconds.
That's not
and like, then
Graylab timers.
Yeah, because my
and then timing in the chemistry is done by a Graylab unit yeah. that was again salvaged from the Fort Niagara darkroom. Yeah,
because I have a Graylab timer. I have one that's with my Bessler 45 MXT.
Yeah.
Works right with it. Has a safe light plug-in, has the timers. Yep. And it even, if I want it to, it beeps for every second that it counts down. And honestly, the other thing that it has that I really, really like is the fact that it also has a foot pedal, which...
Oh, nice.
It makes a huge difference. So instead yeah. of making sure that you can reach for pushing that button on the timer to get the print started.
Mine has a option to plug in a foot pedal, but it unfortunately did not come with it. One of the things with salvaging stuff secondhand is oftentimes parts are missing.
Yeah.
So
the other thing that mine has is also has some phosphorescent tape. So
okay.
The nice thing about that is it doesn't give off a lot of light. But when you're looking for something in the dark, a little bit of light is better than no light at all.
Exactly, exactly.
Or if you're tray developing 4x5 film.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
And so like we said, the good news is that, yes, there are people who will be very happy to sell you enlargers
mm-hmm.
online.
Absolutely.
If you ask around, put out the word in your social network. If anyone has darkroom gear that's cluttering up your basement, yeah. I'll be happy to give you a free space back. And the odds are you'll end up with a lot of free kit or exactly. something very, very inexpensive.
Inexpensive, absolutely.
Now a listener email comes in from a Stephen Ride in North Vancouver, BC.
Hi gang, I live in North Vancouver, BC and have been following the FPP for not quite a year and heard Alex there. I found Alex's blog and there was episode 1 of the CCR. How cool is that? I shoot film, I only shoot film, and I have only ever shot film. Long live film. I shoot on a Pentax K1000, a Nikon F80, and a Kodak Vigilant Junior 620.
Hey, my grandfather had one.
I use black and white film and color slide. I process the black and white at home and will be doing the E6 at home eventually. I get all my film stuff from Beau Photo in Vancouver. They have all the supplies that one needs for their film fetish. The film department is the center of the store and the film camera department is the grandma's attic with all formats available. That's pretty cool. I love this place. The Beau Photo team and are a great bunch of people that are always helpful. Nicole is who I deal with in the film department. She has incredible passion for analog photography, and it shows. I have included an attachment of the store for you to look at. Congratulations on the episode 1, and I look forward to many more. Stephen Ride.
Fantastic. Thanks, Stephen.
Well, I think that about covers it for this show. Mm-hmm. As always, you can find us on Facebook, search for Classic Camera Revival, give us a like. Or if you have any more questions or comments about the show, please send us an email. We're classiccamerarevival@gmail.com. Have a great day, all.
Keep shooting.
And keep them shutters firing.
And remember, digital's for pussies.